but it's true and it's hard to do, is that if we don't appreciate and be grateful and enjoy the way to get there, in free time I say how we bake is as important as what we make. If how we bake is with agita and angst and envy and stress and burnout, why do we think that what we're making is going to be good? Why does anybody want to engage with a product that was made with like self-martyrism, you know, with martyring ourselves and killing ourselves and then being like, oh, here, I killed myself for this. Do you want it? I just don't even think it's going to create the best possible end product. And yet it is just so much easier said than done. It is so hard to be ambitious as a person, like you said, not hold ourselves back, but still be totally content with what is.
This week, I'm sharing part of my conversation with Jenny Blake. Jenny is an author and podcaster. She's written 3 books, but 2, her most recent ones that we talked about in this episode, are Free Time and Pivot. And she also hosts podcasts of the same name. So Pivot with Jenny Blake and the Free Time podcast. We talked about this idea from her book Pivot about being able to make incremental changes in your career and really move yourself into a direction that aligns with what you really want to be doing and how to find joy in your work. And we also talked about her book Free Time and some of the ideas from that. I think it's applicable not just for business owners, but also for busy professionals and really being able to carve out and maximize time and use time in the way that is most productive for you and makes your life one that can be filled with joy and where you can make the time for the things that matter most to you. So if you're an entrepreneur, it's about how you can unravel yourself from busy work and really create time for intentionality. So like I said, I loved this episode. I think you're going to love it too. You can find Jenny on LinkedIn at Jenny Blake and on Twitter at the same name. If you love this episode, please do share it with a friend. And don't forget to leave a review because it helps us tremendously to reach other listeners just like you. Thank you for making the time with your book tours and everything that you've got going on. I know that it's a really busy schedule.
You know what? There's nothing I love more than podcast conversations in either direction, whether I'm interviewing people or they're interviewing me. And I was just thinking today, how lucky am I that I get to do my morning reading, have coffee, and then what? We just hit record and I get to know you, you know, like an awesome new person. I always joke that it's the introvert's guide to making friends because we actually don't just schedule a random coffee. We're doing this for some functional purpose, but at least other people can listen in and then we get to know each other. And it just feels like this is one of the parts of what I do that makes me pinch myself and just say, I get to call this work.
I love that. And actually, that's a perfect segue. So you've had this whole journey and we're going to get into it in a second. But what I'm really interested in, obviously, you wrote this book called Pivot. And I know that you left Google at one point, which was like your dream job at the time. And I've actually done the same. So, you know, there's like some good parallel there. So I was working in corporate law and that is what I always wanted to do. So I'll just go into a bit of backstory on
Please
my end.
Please do. Yeah.
So I actually came to the UK from Nigeria many years ago when I was a lot younger and I came to do some school here. And originally I started doing like design and marketing and that was more out of passion. That was just skills I taught myself and I could use to make some money and was a lot of fun. But obviously the immigrant dream is you have to become like a doctor, a lawyer, something along those lines. And so I decided from, I think when I was 14, that I was going to become a lawyer. And I'd never met one until university. So I was already at uni. It's the first time I actually met a corporate lawyer, even though for years and years I've been saying, this is exactly what I want to do. And while I was at uni, I was still working in marketing. So actually I did some work with Amazon and a bunch of other brands and startups. And then I ended up getting what I thought was my dream job in corporate law at one of my dream firms. And I worked there, I was there for like 5 years. And then I reached a point where eventually I felt like it was time for me to make a pivot of my own. I want to start maybe as far back as you can go. I'd love to know what some of your early career experiences were like and what started taking you in this direction and this trajectory. Did you always have kind of like what I just shared, a very clear vision of what you thought you might want to do? Or was that something you were figuring out as you go along?
I thought I was going to be a journalist. So I started this little family newspaper when I was 10, 11 years old that I produced. It's called the Monthly Dig Up. Every month, all the way through high school, I won this California Journalist of the Year award. I got to be the top 4 finalists in the country in the US that year. And I applied to all these colleges, and even the Medill Northwestern was like the holy grail school of journalism. and they rejected me. And I was so shocked. I was like, I'm top four in the country and this still doesn't get me in. And that was a kind of rattling moment because I was so convinced that I was going to be a journalist. I ended up at UCLA, which is, I was actually very thrilled to go to school there, even though I thought I would end up on the East Coast. I was a news reporter for the Daily Bruin for 1 year. And the lifestyle of that was so stressful and so intense because they would call with a deadline that was 2 days from now and I'd have to drop all my schoolwork. And I realized even then that the pressure of that, and I couldn't quite see financial abundance on the horizon as a journalist. This would have been in 2001. So I kind of put it aside. And that was a strange moment of just thinking, well, yeah, here was this thing I hung my hat on my whole childhood of what I wanted to do. And then who am I? What's interesting to me without that? I was a comms major, ended up adding political science. I almost minored in computer science, but my poli-sci advisor, she offered me a job at a startup in Palo Alto as the first employee. And I think that the founder, this really brilliant Stanford economics professor, I think he just was kind of skeptical, thought I was going to be filing papers. And as soon as I got there, he started giving me all this work because I was also indicating that I could handle all kinds of stuff. So the startup was really fun. I left school. I ended up finishing at UCLA kind of a little bit remotely, a little bit through Stanford classes. And the startup was really where I learned. I mean, we grew from 0 to 30 people. It was on the now famous stretch of University Boulevard in Palo Alto. And when I hit a plateau there, that's when I started interviewing at Google and moved over to Google. So it was interesting to go from a teeny startup doing political polling, and then Google, which was at that time had 6,000 people. So I was there as it grew to 36,000. All the while, during that time, on the side, I started blogging. And that let me kind of express my computer nerd side, teaching myself coding and HTML in order to do some of my job at the startup. But blogging is where that journalism thing comes full circle. And now podcasting, which is the current love of my life, it's the same thing. It's like journalism, even coaching that I ended up doing at Google. Coaching, journalism, podcasting, blogging, they all have curiosity in common and communicating with people and taking in ideas and then packaging them and synthesizing them and publishing back out. The common threads are there, but the actual forms they've taken have changed over the years.
I love that. And I wanted to ask how you found during that period managing all of these interests that you had, because I think that's one thing that people, more so, I would say maybe very early in their careers, but actually it carries on through later in their careers. People that have competing interests, but they still work and they want to be able to balance. It might not necessarily be a side hustle, but it's a hobby, right? You enjoyed doing this journalism. You started this blog. I'm sure maybe the blog started to grow. People were reading it and you started to find a passion in doing and publishing that. How did you find being able to balance that with what you were doing for work?
It was tricky. Always. I talk about this in Free Time, my third book, that the inner time blueprint that I was raised with, whether nature, nurture, society, I grew up in San Francisco, was just this frenetic pace. Like day was filled from A to Z, morning, noon, and night with activities. That was like the form of childcare, you know, and then I did it to myself. And then as I got into high school, I put the pressure on myself and college and Google. And so I always had this overflowing plate and I was always hitting burnout. In some ways, it was very satisfying to juggle that many things. I felt fulfilled doing that. And then also, I probably took on too much and I did that over and over again until I started to be able to have full autonomy over my time and craft a more balanced existence. But in the early days, still to this day, I learn the hard way. Who are we kidding? It's not like there's ever a there. I find that even if I get my sort of work patterns under control, then my life complexity grows. Like, oh, I got married. Oh, we have a house now. Oh, we have a dog. So I joke that it's like the number of browser tabs open at any given time is 5x what it was when I was in my 20s. In my 20s, though, I had a tremendous amount of just overall anxiety. And I joke that I have 10,000 hours of neurosis under my belt. Like if I was a master at anything, it was worrying. And at least the blogging and the side hustles helped me work through some of that. And I was always so afraid to post the really vulnerable writing. And I call it now truth while it's fresh. And yet those would be the posts that people would share the most. Those would be the ones that people would write in the most. Those would be the ones that even had coworkers coming up and talking to me. So I started to realize that we all crave that. Nobody really wants to hear about someone's like state of perfection. I mean, yes, that can be informative too, but I find it more interesting to talk about the process and the imperfection and the insecurity and the uncertainty. That's really, those are some of the big themes behind Pivot. It's not like, oh, here's this process that you'll never have doubt again. It's like, if you're racked by uncertainty and anxiety and insecurity, like I often am, here's a process that will still help you move forward and do creative things, even with those things carried alongside you.
I really agree with that. And I think there's a few things that stuck out to me from what you were sharing, but I think, okay, so one is finding this sense of control within your schedule. And I think that's one thing that I personally found hard, and I'm sure a lot of people will probably empathize, is that it can feel really difficult when you hear, so I have a lot of people on this podcast, and I'm sure people have a lot of other points of reference that they see out in the world, where it's very easy to see people that are completely in control of their time, and they're not completely working full-time, or they're working full-time on their own thing, like of something they've created. And so they are able to set their schedule and say, okay, I'm going to work on this, I'm going to work on that. And so a lot of the advice that some of those people might give, or a lot of the perception that you might see, is from people that have complete control. Whereas there's also a lot of people like you were once upon a time, that you feel like all of that time pressure is being imposed on you, and you are almost subject to everyone else's timing. You have to follow everyone else's clock. That's how it can feel. So how did you maybe start to disentangle yourself from those feelings and start taking active control of your time, even when, at least at first, you were still on other people's clocks to an extent?
One of the things, working at a company like Google, and I'm curious to hear about your experience too, is that there was a saying, even working there, the bar is always raising. And we were at that time, I know they've shifted how they do performance evaluations in recent years, but at that time, you get 2 performance reviews a year, and the goal is to be always exceeding expectations and always working toward a promotion. And even if the managers weren't reinforcing that idea, because often it was the early in career people who were obsessed with promotion, and there's only one CEO, like at some point in your career, you got to realize promotion isn't the end all be all to happiness. It's actually quite a stressful goal. So there was a point around year 4 of my Google tenure out of 5.5 where I realized that striving to get promoted again was not serving me. And I had been promoted twice quickly early on when I first joined. But that next level, the amount of stress and pressure that I was putting on myself, even beyond the time boundaries, you know, placed around me just by nature of working at a full-time job in a very intense company, the obsession with getting to the next level and the next was actually hurting me. And there was this moment, this aha moment, where I said, you know what? I'm earning enough. My title is fine. Like, I was a level 4. That's not going to mean anyone to anyone else. But I was not even qualified. I co-created and launched this global drop-in coaching program called Career Guru. When I created it, when I was training the managers and directors on how to coach others, I was not even qualified to be a career guru of this program of my own design. And yet, when I realized I don't care if I get promoted again, it was so freeing. And I actually thought to myself, what's the worst that can happen if I stop trying to get promoted? I thought, well, maybe they'll fire me. Okay, well, that will take at least 6 months, because for the first 3 months, they'll start to notice. Then they'll put me on a performance plan. Then will be another 3 to 6 months before they give me the boot if I don't turn things around. And I was willing to have that be a consequence on some level. Instead, I kept exceeding expectations. So then what that taught me was that actually I could scale back my obsession a little bit and the burnout and still perform. So that this association of just pure nose to the grindstone hard work, it does not always correlate to performance and results, especially as you get to higher levels, especially when you run your own business. There is not a linear correlation between hard work and results. And in fact, sometimes it's harder to work less because you have to be more strategic and you have to delegate more and more creative and think outside the box. So that was really something that helped me even when I was still within corporate, was just relaxing the sort of arbitrary standards. I mean, on some level, they're not arbitrary because they're associated with salary and other kinds of benefits. But at some point, I think it's helpful to realize and be grateful that what I have is enough. And this is okay for now.
Yeah, I love the idea of finding enough. I think that's something, being honest, I've struggled with quite recently as well. Being in maybe, I don't know if it's exactly the same position, but a similar-ish position where this reminds me of, and I think you talk about this in free time as well, which is Parkinson's law, where essentially, you know, the amount of time you spend on something expands to fill whatever time you've allocated to it. But I think the same applies to hard work in some ways, where, or to ambition, right? Whatever ambition you set, the work that you do to fill that can always expand. And because a lot of people, and I think even for me right now, I'm kind of at an inflection point where I'm thinking about that now, is because for most people, there is not a specific concrete and finite level that they are expecting of what their ambition might be or what they're hoping to reach. And it's not to say that you should limit yourself, but it's to say, you know, okay, if you have this objective, what fulfills that objective right now? And at what point will you allow yourself to be happy? Because I think that is the real critical issue, is that a lot of people end up feeling like because they haven't achieved something and they don't yet know what it is, they can't be happy and they can't allow themselves to rest. And they have to keep pushing the boundaries and keep pushing whatever it is. And so you're doing all this work. And I found that as well, where I do all this work. And long, long ago, I've probably already achieved 3 or 4 of the things that I said were going to be the prerequisite to me being able to happy and me being able to relax. But as soon as you hit that, you kind of move the boundary out again. And then you're like, ah, now I'm so far from where I could be or where I should be. And so you're on this perpetual treadmill. Hey, we'll get back to the episode in just one moment, but I wanted to tell you very quickly about my newsletter. I started sharing everything I was learning online and a few thousand people came along for the ride. I send 3 regular emails. Brainwave, fortnightly on a Tuesday, which is about the intersection between technology, philosophy, and psychology. Then every week on a Thursday, I send Revelations, and that's about creativity and productivity. And then finally, every other weekend, I send Wayfinder, and that's about decision making. So people in the audience actually send me really tough problems that they're working through, and I help to deconstruct them using mental models and decision-making frameworks. So if you'd like to subscribe, you can join me and over 20,000 incredibly driven people at theknowledge.io. Okay, back to the episode.
It is so tricky. I'm just reading a book. I heard Andrew Wilkinson talking to Shane Parrish on Shane's podcast about this book, and it's blowing my mind too. It's called Wanting: The Power of Mimetic Desire in Everyday Life by Luke Burgess. And it's the idea that we learn what to want, what to desire by looking at other people. And I think now with social media the way that it is, and even the sexiness of startup culture or entrepreneurship, and oh my goodness, same as you, David, like I find that, oh, it is so hard not to just constantly be comparing myself to others and measuring, oh, how many podcast listeners do I have? How many newsletter subscribers? How much money am I making? How much money are they making? How much money should I want to be making? You know, like every metric, it is so hard not to just look over the fence. And I do. There's even a chapter in Free Time, a sidebar, Eyes on Your Own Paper, where I try to remind myself, okay, keep your eyes on your own paper. You're on your own project. You're doing your own thing. And what you said, what's so hard is not to say, I'll be happy when, because that bar is always changing. Oh, I'll be happy when I'm earning this much from my podcast or this much in my business. Or, and then the irony of that as well is that if we're not happy in the building process, and I know this gets to all the mindfulness self-help cliches, but it's true and it's hard to do, is that if we don't appreciate and be grateful and enjoy the way to get there, in Free Time, I say how we bake is as important as what we make. If how we bake is with agita and angst and envy and stress and burnout, why do we think that what we're making is going to be good? Why does anybody want to engage with a product that was made with like self-martyrism? You know, maybe that's a redundant word, martyring, you know, with martyring ourselves and killing ourselves and then being like, oh, here, I killed myself for this. Do you want it? I just don't even think it's going to create the best possible end product. And yet it is just so much easier said than done. It is so hard to be ambitious as a person, like you said, not hold ourselves back, but still be totally content with what is. It's like, I think it's a polarity that is almost ever present.
Yeah. And you make a really good point by referencing Wanting as well by Luke Burgess. I've talked about that a few times in my newsletter. And it's such an interesting idea because I like how he talks about, I think it's negative and positive models. But the point being that, so you have models of people that are close to you that kind of give you desires. So that could be your parents or people that are in very close proximity to you. But then through social media, we also have these models that are a lot further away. And the difficult part about that is that you have no idea the actual content of the rest of their lives, because what social media allows people to do is to curate what you show, right? And it's so funny. Okay, I'm not sure if you've seen, but on Twitter quite recently and through TikTok. So I've seen some people within tech make these TikToks. It's typically like a Gen Z thing of like, oh, here was my day as a product manager or something like that. And people show their day as this glamorous, you know, I came out of bed, I took an Uber to the office, we had some biscuits and some granola and you know, a completely healthy day. We had all this fun. We went to this party off, all of the highlights of their day. People are hate it and people are so angry and everyone's in the comments lambasting them and just talking about how terrible they are and how terrible it is that we just pay people to do nothing. And it's like, I don't know if anyone else is like watching in between the gaps, because this day started early in the morning and ended late at night. And although the only clips that you see in this video are the parts where, you know, they went and had some free lunch, clearly this is not a 12-hour video for their entire workday. This is literally just the 2-second highlights. The entire video is 15 seconds long or however long. And so I think that is the part that it's so easy to miss, right? It's so easy just to see and notice and be hung up on the highlights. And you see someone is having this kind of success. You see someone's having this kind of fun and it feels like you're not having it. And it can be easy to become angry and feel dissatisfied as a result of that. But you're not seeing everything else that comes with that package and all of the other work that they're doing and everything else that they might have to do. And I think that is when it can be easy to start feeling drained by what we have to do and the things that we put ourselves through. Just like you were saying, this self-flagellation where we're flogging ourselves and making ourselves do all this work. But very often, you know, we are trying to create something that actually doesn't exist, because what we're trying to create is what we think is someone else's reality. And that reality is not even that person's reality. So we are all ending up chasing fantasies.
It's true. And we make the assumption that how they feel on the inside is how it looks on the outside. But there's nothing telling you that that person isn't racked with anxiety throughout that entire day. And that's what I find so interesting, too, that we assume that if we have all those things, then we'll feel really good all day long, all day, every day. And that's not true. Like just yesterday morning, I had a funny experience. I was walking my dog and they're filming a movie in my neighborhood and we ran into a celebrity. She's like A-list, you know, you would know her. And she had her dog with her. And so we start talking. She's talking to my dog and I'm asking her about hers. I didn't like let on that I knew who she was, but I said like something about her dog. He looks like such a good boy. And she's like, he is a good boy. He's 13 and he just came through chemo. And I thought to myself, you know what? This woman who is this A-list gorgeous celebrity, first of all, at 7 a.m. with her coffee, looks just like anyone else on the block. You know, like if she wasn't instantly recognizable, she's like anyone else. And then nothing, no amount of money can prevent her heartbreak that her dog is 13 or that he just went through chemo, that she still has her heartstrings pulled in every direction by life the same way that any of us would. And even though she's there shooting a movie and has this like glamorous job, but also the mechanics of shooting a movie are you get arrive at 7 a.m. and she sits in a tiny trailer all day that's parked on our block, you know, like, I don't know. It was just this moment where I really thought about, I'm like, she's probably making a gazillion dollars for this movie. But so what? Like, here we are running into each other on the street like it's nothing. And it's just a reminder. It's a constant reminder that we can never know the interiority of somebody's experience, no matter what they have. And the reason I'm reading Wanting, it's so cool that it's already on your radar, is because I keep struggling with this. And I heard on a podcast the other day that people will hate listen to a podcast twice as long as the ones who like it. So like the ones who don't like what's being said will engage with content for twice as long. And the connection I'll make here is that I was always resisting watching the Kardashians. And finally, I just watched the latest season because I couldn't get it out of the algorithm of my Hulu account. And like, I was just drawn by curiosity. And the amount of wanting that the show invokes of like, how many followers, how much glamour, how much cosmetic procedure, how much clothing, how much interior house decorating. Like, oh my God, and of course, you know, I watched the whole season after that, David. You know, I didn't just stop at one episode. I watched the whole thing, like almost mouth agape at how much wanting it was sparking in me. And that it must be doing that for gazillions of people because they have such a ginormous platform around the world. So I feel like they are a real expression of this idea of mimetic desire of we see what other people have and therefore we want.
And funnily enough, so exactly what you were saying also brings me back to what I was saying about when I was working in law. I think you have these shows like Suits that really glamorize it. And obviously I was, you know, already working by the time that started and stuff. But it's really funny how. So people have asked me, or at the time, so before I started working in startups, when I was still working in law, they were like, oh, is it like Suits? And I'm like, actually, it kind of is. Okay, take out all of the drama, all of the exciting stuff. And again, this goes back to what we were saying before. If you watch Suits again, you will realize that the majority of the show happens at night. The reason it happens at night is because people are working. And so without the drama and all of that nice stuff, the reality of that show is that the majority of the time, they're just working from early in the morning, late at night. That's it. So imagine that as your life. And it's not, there's nothing wrong with that. And I did it for 5 years and it's great. But I think, you know, for me, it got to a point where I was looking at partners and people. That was my original desire. I was like, okay, I'm going to come into this law firm, one of the biggest law firms in the world. I want to be a partner, blah, blah, blah. And then you just watch people saying goodnight to their children on FaceTime and having to, like, they would go on family holidays and then come back after 2 days and that the rest of their family's still on holiday and they have to change their plans and they have to come into the office and they are voluntarily coming in on weekends, even though no one has to do any work. I don't know. It was just not what I ended up envisioning for what I wanted my future to be. And so it's really interesting where you start to have these kind of crisis points or pivot points where the vision of what you thought you wanted starts to diverge from the reality. And so I'm interested to get to know, maybe for you, I know you touched on this, but maybe at the point where you then ended up leaving Google and obviously going on to write Pivot as well, what made you realize it was time to make that
change?
Well,
yeah, my first book. So I was an early blog to book success story, if you will, because I had a tiny number of newsletter subscribers, I think 500 in 2010 when I got the book deal. But at that time, it was a lot. Just to have a blog and a newsletter was like, oh, you're already onto something. But sure enough, it got me a book deal. I was rejected 27 times. Some one said yes, that's all it takes. So I was working on the book on nights and weekends. And by the time it was coming out in 2011, I intended only to take a 3-month sabbatical. Very quickly, about a week in, I realized, oh, this side hustle could take all day, every day, and it is. And it would not be fair to myself, to the new direction, which at that time was life after college, or to Google, or to my team, if I keep trying to do both. I will completely burn out, and I will not do a good job at any of it. And that's when I felt that I really had to make a choice. And I was 27. I felt like, if I'm not going to bet on myself now, when will I? I got to try. It was the first time in my life that I thought I have 6 months of savings in the bank. And it was the first time I was willing to spend every penny of it, run it to the ground and know that I tried. Because up till that point, I had been very frayed. My inner CFO was really strict. I was like saving birthday money since I was 8. I was really meticulous about money and really kind of paranoid. And finally, I was willing to spend that little savings account. And sure enough, a month after, so I gave my 2 weeks notice toward the end of my sabbatical. And I didn't need to dip into that savings for 2 years. So my sheer paranoia and motivation not to prove everybody wrong who said I was an idiot to leave just got me through the first 2 years. But surely enough, that type of motivation to earn is going to fizzle out because it's more running away from fear rather than running towards something that's more of a magnet. I think at that time, it was the right move for me. And I also was ready for a simpler career setup. And also, I wanted to have a bigger impact. So I knew that I could, at that time, I could impact about 33,000 Googlers by working internally in people operations. And I just wondered what would be possible if I could speak out to the world. And Google is still a client to this day, and they have been for 10 years. So I love Google. They're still like, I call them like my angel corporate alma mater. Like so much in my life to this day is thanks to Google. So I'm truly still grateful. And I just like working from the outside. And the amazing thing is that they run Pivot programs globally internally. It was so cool to hear Googlers experiencing the material. And I think that for them, my story is a Google success story in the sense that you can pivot in and out of the company and within the company. And so I think it kind of fits the whole idea of pivoting as well, that we still work together just in a slightly different container.
Sure. And I'd love to, let's dig into some of the principles that you discuss in Pivot, because what you were just sharing actually is very similar to my story, although I think it didn't end differently. But okay, so
and
when I left,
I'm also curious what you're doing now, what your current context is.
Ah, okay. So I left my job in law. I did a very similar thing, saved a 6-month runway because for more context, when I was working in law, like you, actually, I started developing my own interests. I taught myself some photography and started being able to shoot like lots of really interesting things. I was going to fashion weeks. I did like London Fashion Week, New York Fashion Week. I was going around doing all kinds of cool stuff or fun stuff. But then I was also consulting for businesses and startups as well. So I mentioned I'd done some consulting and I'd done some marketing before as well. So I was consulting for startups in a blend of like legal stuff, marketing stuff, and brand strategy, growth strategy. And so I was doing all of that on the side. And it got to a point where I thought, okay, you know, I'd love to be able to, I'm doing a lot with the minimal time that I have. Like when I say minimal time, so what I used to do, and it was tough. I was thinking about this earlier. So I had a full-time secretary at work. So you have a full-time secretary at work. And then I also hired someone outside of work that was also working for me, that was helping me just to manage all of this stuff. So I had all of this support and it was still not that much. And I was still having to just work like super early mornings. That was pretty much my time. And it still is. That's exactly how I still do things now. I just wake up at 4:30 and it means that I have time to like, I almost have my own mini day before I go to work. But even at the time, I was just thinking, okay, if I can do this much with this little time, what if I had the whole day? And so I was like, okay, I saved this 6 month runway. I eventually quit. That was a process of its own. I think it had been in the back of my mind since the beginning of that year. And then it got to towards the end of the year. And I was like, okay, fine. This is enough. We're done. And so, yeah, I left and I started and it was going okay. But then after, I think, so I had the initial 6 months, that was okay. And it was like 7 months, 8 months. Okay. And then this is actually just before the pandemic. So I remember we had, yeah, like a few months going into Christmas and then coming out of Christmas. And then suddenly I had to extend that 6 months to like 12 months plus. And then that was like a really tough period where, you know, I still had consulting clients, but it was stretched. And so I did that in total for maybe about 18 months before. So now I joined a startup full time. So first as chief of staff and then now in product strategy. But it is, I mean, that was voluntary. So it wasn't as a result of any poor circumstances. But what I wanted to dig in with you is thinking about a lot of what you discuss in Pivot and some of those principles. I think a lot that stood out for me is about how you think about pivoting in advance and you start thinking and planning for what you want to do and what you're going to go on to do before it happens and before you're almost forced to do it.
What I found most interesting with pivoters that I spoke with was that they always said in hindsight, it was so obvious what the next move was. Like in hindsight, the answer was right underneath my feet. And that we're often so close to ourselves and our career that we don't see it. We feel confused. We're having this existential crisis. Who am I? What do I want? What's next? And so I learned two big things about pivoting. One, it's not productive, though it is tempting, that we just obsess over what's not working, what we don't want, what we don't have. This goes back to the thing of wanting. But we're focused on the negative, what's not working. And we complain to friends and family about work. Ultimately, that doesn't produce a pivot output. It just keeps us stuck. So the first secret is you just look at what is working, even if it's 5 or 10%. What is the part that you are enjoying? And if we can double down on that, even if it's not a full-time role, that starts to grow and it starts to expand. And we naturally grow into the next direction, especially in technology, especially in startups. I've seen so many people create their own roles. It's just absolutely one of my favorite phenomenon to watch of somebody starting something small. Even my Career Guru project that I mentioned started as a 10% project. And then only later when a career development team was formed, one did not exist when I started that. When the team was formed, I was able to move on to it. And the second part of pivoting, it's more of a continuous process. Like we don't have the answer up front. We actually don't just solve the pivot and say, oh, now I know what's next and boom, 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 let me move into it. It's actually that you run a series of pilots or experiments. I compare it to racehorses at the Kentucky Derby, or you don't get to know the winner in advance. You actually just run these experiments and then they show you which one takes off and gets momentum. And only by experiencing that momentum among one of the many pilots do you then, you're shown what has energy, where to go next and where to double down. And so those are, I would say, two of the big learnings from the pivot process. And the third that I kind of mentioned is just this idea that it's not a surprise. The reason it's a pivot and not a 180 is that it is connected to something you're already doing. And that's where we just got to get curious and look at, okay, what's here already? What's here now? Acknowledge that and then dive in. So sometimes it's a process of stripping away what's not working, like cleaning out a closet. So cleaning out a closet, it's like, you know what's not a fit and you got to do it every couple of years because clutter accumulates.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's exactly what I wanted to highlight from what you just shared as well, because it was really interesting to me just thinking about. So I was talking with this girl called Emma, and she started a business during the pandemic as well, actually. But she had been fired and then started this business and made, I think at the time, about £2.6 million, like literally just in that period, which is incredible. But it's the fact that it wasn't instant, and it sounds instant, but it wasn't, because even when she was working before that, she'd already started building some of these skills. And actually, okay, I'll take it back two steps. I think she was working in a previous job, had started learning some copywriting skills. Then that led to being able to get a copywriting job. And then while working in that job, she's still building skills. So my point is just that all of these things are still incremental. And it's really easy to draw a straight line in retrospect. Like you said, you know, everything was clear when you look back. And I remember writing a newsletter a long time ago, which was about, I think it was called like Legends of Success or something like that, where I was talking about, I think what sparked it was I was listening to someone that they read some book, or they were telling me about like ninjas and Spartans and stuff, or Spartans, yeah. And it was really interesting reading into that for myself and realizing that when people think of Spartans, they think of, wow, this, you know, the Battle of Thermopylae and all of these great stories. But the irony is that is not necessarily, I mean, it's the truth, but it's not the whole truth. Because before that battle, that was not what the Spartans were known for. They had a completely different reputation. But, you know, there was this inflection point, and then that started to change how people thought about them. And so it's in retrospect that we're able to draw this line and say, ah, this is how it was, and this is how it always was. And I think in careers and in our lives, it can be very much the same, where in retrospect, we can draw this straight line and say, ah, yes, of course, you know, I did this, and then I did that, and this is the story. But in reality, there's often many inflection points on the way where you're learning things and you're taking these small incremental steps. And actually, maybe it's the fact that you've been building this skill in the background that doesn't seem super relevant now, but it's something you enjoy, that if you spend more time on it, then, you know, one or two steps down the line, suddenly that is what leads to opportunities.
Yes, so true. I call those interim pivots or leapfrog pivots, where you actually know what you want 2 moves out, but you're not ready yet, or you don't have the experience yet. And so it's okay to take something that's not the end all be all. I think we're doing this more now than ever. It's funny you mentioned the Spartans, because my husband has a giant Spartan tattoo. So he's like really into the lore. So I'm like thinking, tell me more. So it was such a curious choice that he made to really go all in on Sparta. I have been thinking lately, I wonder what your take is. And also, I think chief of staff is a very fascinating job title. So I'd be curious to hear more about that. But I think now what I'm finding is getting a little further along in my career. I'm turning 39 this fall. Is it starts to narrow what I'm qualified for. Like, actually, you know, I don't know. I was just for fun, I was looking at Google's jobs the other day, and I thought, what am I even qualified for at this point in my career, where other people have an MBA and they have all this corporate experience? And meanwhile, what have I been up to? I'm like podcasting and writing newsletters. And yes, there is plenty I've learned about running my tiny media company. But it was kind of wild to realize as well that you do make choices about what to get better at, what to invest all this time in, and where to build the network. And that it does kind of, over time, it opens many doors and it also closes other ones. And I just think that that's a very interesting thing to realize, like all the sliding doors careers, that when you're really early on in your early 20s, you can kind of pick anything and go in any direction. And then I'm finding now, as approaching kind of mid-career zone, the niche, it gets, as one of my mentors says, an inch wide and a mile deep, but it really starts to specialize. I don't have any grand aha or conclusion on that yet. It's just something I've been pondering.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please do stay tuned for more. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the podcast. and follow me on Twitter. Feel free to shoot me any thoughts. See you next time.